My name's Jerry Harder. I'm with Seattle Insight Meditation Society, and I am happy to welcome for Sims, our guest tonight, Kimberly Morgan, who is coming to us from Portland this evening. And I didn't know who Kimberly was, and I saw her bio. I said, this is going to be interesting. Just a lot of in that bio really appealed to me, non-dual approach to our practice. I'm looking forward to it. And I think we all made a good choice of coming inside and having a Zoom meeting this evening, regardless of the weather. I see more nice weather tomorrow. So let me say something about Kimberly. She is a meditation teacher, a nonprofit founder, speaker, and author. She's the founder of Peace in Schools, a nonprofit that created the nation's first four-credit mindfulness class in the public schools. Kimberly is also the founder of Presence Collective, a community of cross-cultural contemplatives committed to personal and collective transformation. She is the author of a kid's book about mindfulness. And she recently wrote The Heart of Who We Are, Realizing Freedom Together, which she will be talking about this evening. Kimberly blends the original spirit of Zen with a modern non-dual approach. Her practice began in 1995 and included 8 years of training in a silent Zen monastery. She's been teaching contemplative practice since 2001. She speaks publicly at conferences on topics including contemplative practice, personal and collective transformation, social entrepreneurship, authentic leadership, and mindfulness education. Quite a range. And she has been featured on publications such as Mindful Magazine, as well as the New York Times. Before I turn it over to Kimberly, I want to say something about Donna. She is here this evening offering these teachings, freely offer in the tradition of our practice. And she requests that any Donna, the Donna that you offer this evening, goes to the Peace in Schools, the nonprofit that I referred to earlier. So 100% of the teacher Donna go to Peace in Schools. She founded that practice, founded that organization, which brings mindfulness into public high schools, and where she serves as a lead contemplative. So I'm going to drop that in the chat right now, and probably remind you about that later. And there's also a description of Peace in Schools, which sounds quite intriguing. So again, I welcome Kimberly Morgan. Thank you for being here, Kimberly. Appreciate it, and look forward to what you have offering us this evening. Thank you.
Jerry, thank you so very much. I'm delighted to be here, friends. Hello. It's very good to see you. As you heard, I'm just down here in Portland, so not too far away. And I would love to, since we're a small group tonight, I'd love to begin by very briefly bringing all voices into the room. So let's start with a mindful minute. So coming into any position that you want to come into, and beginning by taking three of the longest and deepest inhalations and exhalations you've taken yet today. And then with no judgment, notice where your attention is in this moment. Is it on thinking mind? Any specific emotions? Is your attention attending to something from earlier in the day? Are you thinking about what's next, perhaps? Perhaps your attention is absorbed in sensations. Simply notice. And then one more deep inhalation and exhalation. And if you would, take a moment to, the way we're going to bring voices into the room tonight is to begin by bringing voices into the chat. So later there'll be time for Q&A and engagement and discussion. But for now, if you would, type in the chat one thing that's alive for you in this moment. Something that's here now, something that you notice that your attention was on, yeah, present to your breath. Thank you, Cheryl. No wrong answer here, of course. Sun coming in the window. It's alive here now. Light. Thank you, Dory. Deep breaths is bringing a sense of peace. It's nice, Jessica, isn't it, to be reminded how accessible a sense of peace is. Sometimes it's as simple as remembering to pause, to breathe for a few minutes. Not even a few minutes, just a few deep breaths. Yeah, thank you. The gathering of Sangha members, Jerry, true. So delicious. Relax. Warmth. Beautiful. Present to bird song, my voice. Great. Thank you, friends. Feeling of peace and calm. Stillness. At some point very soon here, actually maybe now, I'm going to go ahead and put my readers on, y'all, because I almost said silliness, which is different than stillness. Classical piano. Thanks, Don. Yeah, I just turned 50, y'all. So I've just hit the milestone of knowing that it's going to be a lot better for everyone if I use my readers as I read. Sobering. So speaking of reading, I thought I would begin tonight by reading a little bit from this book. This book was, it's funny, before I wrote this book, I heard so many authors say, oh, this book was a labor of love. And I often would have a sense of being curious about what that meant for them. And I really know what that means now, that so much got poured into this book. The book is titled The Heart of Who We Are, Realizing Freedom Together. It's came out through Sounds True at the end of last year. I feel very lucky that I got a lovely cover designer. And it's been a joy to share this work in various communities. And I wanted to share some of it tonight. And I specifically wanted to offer a practice from the book. So this book, how many of those here, just raise your hand visually, how many of you had not heard about this book yet? Great, wonderful. So it's so lovely to get to share it with you. So this book came from a desire to share my experience of founding the nonprofit Peace in Schools and to share what it's been like to have practice, deep practice, be something that teens can engage with. And I say deep practice because Peace in Schools created the first semester-long credited mindfulness course in the country. And so we're now in most of the public high schools in Portland, and we're expanding. We're actually in conversation with many Bay Area schools at the moment for expansion. And so I wanted to share about my experience in those classrooms, but I specifically wanted to share about this, the experience from the perspective of how what I was seeing, in fact, impacts our practices as adults. So it's not a book about teen mindfulness. You know, sounds true. Actually, several publishing companies approached me. And at the beginning, in the early days, many people just wanted me to write something about teens and mindfulness. But this book goes way beyond that, because this book shares stories about my experience in the classrooms, but through the lens of letting Peace in Schools be a template of sorts regarding what's possible for us in collective shared practice community. So the book stems from my experience being a monastic for 8 years in the Zen tradition. I lived and trained in a silent Zen monastery for 8 years. And that those practices that were so transformative to me, I became incredibly interested in how those practices could be applied collectively. Because when I was training monastically, we left the collective out entirely. So we were never talking about anything other than personal liberation. We weren't talking about collective liberation in the context that I trained in. So I became very intrigued about that. And as you're hearing, I began to see how collective transformation worked when working in these classroom settings. I saw it, I felt it, I learned what the ingredients were. And then because you all are of the Insight Meditation community, I think it'll potentially interest you to know that I came too from a progressive path approach to practice. And one thing that impacted my training, my own practice very deeply, was the exposure to a non-dual approach. And that happened after my monastic training. And so what became very interesting to me in this book project was to guide the reader from a progressive approach to a direct approach. So to support a practitioner in experiencing contemplative technologies and tools that I knew were so transformative on a personal and collective level, but to take folks through an arc in which they might have a direct experience of who they authentically are, who we authentically are, to know the heart of who we are without needing to jump through a lot of hoops in order to have that experience. So I thought what I'd do tonight is just share a little bit from the book. And because I wanted to specifically bring in Peace in Schools tonight, I thought I would start right at the top of chapter 7, which is called Return to Unity and Seeing Through Duality. So I'll be jumping in to share that with you. But I also wanted to include this evening a meditation. And I would love to begin with a meditation now that you have a little bit of frame for the evening. You've heard we're going to have a meditation. I'm going to share some from the book. We'll have time, as I mentioned, to be in dialogue and have some Q&A. But I would love to start off with a meditation, and I'll just let you know, if you're new to language about direct approach and progressive approach, you'll have an experience of that in this meditation. So I'm going to focus in the meditation on first a more progressive path approach to our meditation practice, and then we'll shift the attention in the meditation to a direct experience, a more direct experience. So if you have any questions before I begin, or anything you want to clarify about what I've shared so far, feel free to just put that in the chat. And then I can make sure to be addressing what's alive in the room as we move into becoming settled for an experience of sitting meditation. So come into the meditation position that's best for you this evening. And before we even begin with, again, I'm going to guide this meditation. I'm going to guide and share two different approaches, but I'm going to weave them together. Before I even go there, take a moment to listen to the body. Look to see if it might feel nice to stretch the body for a few moments before you move into stillness. Whether there's anything you'd like to do that would take care of the body before we move into stillness. Perhaps some gentle head or neck rolls, or a twisting of the spine. Right. Begin this meditation by turning all of your attention to the breath. Perhaps your attention today has been bouncing from thing to thing to thing. Steady the attention now. Gather it by focusing on the breath. When the attention wanders off, notice where it's gone. Mm-hmm. And then without judgment, return to the breath. Now imagine for a moment that the attention was like a flashlight. And just as we began today with that mindful minute, you might have noticed that the attention was landing on thoughts or warmth or birdsong or my voice or light or a feeling of peace and calm, that the attention was landing in these places. Imagine a flashlight with the attention landing on these things that you've named. Now notice that even the attention landing on the breath, it's like another subtle object. So objects being voice, birdsong, light, peace, warmth, stillness, classical piano, green trees and leaves. So this is a progressive path approach to train the attention to be where we want it to be, to place it on the object of our choice rather than having it run off in past or future worry, regret, striving, seeking, resisting. Now notice how even the breath is another subtle object. Not bad, not wrong. Now we're going to transition. So imagine this flashlight with the attention being directed outward. I want to invite the attention to rest, to relax back in its source. So the light resting back in the flashlight itself. So now in this approach, we're freeing the attention. Rather than focusing it or directing it, we're softening the attention. We're freeing the attention to relax and rest in awareness itself. So for this meditation, you can go back to a concentration practice for your next meditation, but for this meditation, we're releasing the concentration. We're allowing the attention to rest in the source. Rather than the attention moving outward to an object, again, even a subtle object like the breath, we're freeing the attention from objects, and we're allowing the attention to soften open to be. It's as though you're allowing the attention to come home. Like you're letting the attention rest in the very place it's almost always arising out of, so that it can land on various objects. birdsong, light, breath, warmth, various Sangha members, a feeling of peace and calm. The attention is habitually moving outward. Even when it's being directed to something that's here and now. Allow the attention now to draw back into the heart of who you are. Into your very being. Let the attention rest. When you feel the attention rise up and land on an object, thoughts or feelings, sensations, seeking, resisting, simply notice that. And invite the attention to return to resting. Invite the attention to return to an experience of relaxing in being. So again, like a flashlight, rather than the light beam landing on an object, simply allowing that light to draw back into the flashlight itself. Resting there. Being there. Nothing you have to do. Know where you have to go. And most importantly, know one you have to be. The last 10 minutes of this sit will be in silence. If you're enjoying this resting in being, resting the attention in awareness itself approach, please continue. And if there's anything about it that's not resonating for you, simply go back to the approach of your choice. There's no right or wrong. But the last 10 minutes will be unguided. Thank you. So, friends, I'm delighted to transition into sharing some of my book with you. It's fun for me to read some of my book. It makes me feel like story time a little bit or something. So here we are on this Friday evening. It's story time, which does remind me. Thank you, Jerry, for mentioning my kids' book. So if you do have young people in your life, I did also write this kids' book about mindfulness. And what I love about this specific kids' book is that if you don't know this company, a kids' book about, they're incredible. They've written a book. They have a whole range of books, a kids' book about cancer, a kids' book about money, a kids' book about racism, a kids' book. So the idea was that it would be how to talk to kids about things that sometimes we don't know how to talk about. And so I was invited to write the kids' book about mindfulness. But what I liked about getting to work on that project is there was a deep invitation to go wherever I wanted with it. And so I actually focused a lot on this direct approach rather than only focusing on what I think of as more traditional mindfulness, which is simply directing the attention, placing it where you want it to be without judgment. So it was a joy to write. But for tonight, I want to share an excerpt from this adult book, the newer book, The Heart of Who We Are, Realizing Freedom Together. And I imagine many of you are familiar with Ruth King from the Insight tradition. So this chapter starts with a quote from Ruth King. This chapter is called Return to Unity, Seeing Through Duality. Ultimate reality and relative reality are to be understood as two expressions of one truth, two sides of one coin. Ultimate reality is often associated with the ocean and relative reality with the waves. Ultimate reality is like the sky, and relative reality is all that appears and disappears in the sky. Ruth King. In peace in schools, our classes take place in a circle. The experience is leveled for the benefit of all. The intention behind the form is to create a reflection of our unity rather than an us-them dichotomy. Lan always sat beside me in class. Even though there were no assigned seats in mindful studies, Lan always arrived early enough to claim the cushion to my right. As Peace in Schools teachers, we often shake up the seating. Everything about the class is intentional. It's always been important to me that teachers keep an eye out for cliques that might form. As creatures, we're so habituated to the social pattern of creating them. It's difficult to have cliques without reinforcing an experience of othering, especially in high school. Usually a particular vibrancy, aliveness, and sense of belonging arises when students are invited to intersect with others they might not normally engage with. As teachers, we do our best to create such opportunities. Of course, there are exceptions to every rule. I knew Lan was on the autism spectrum, and I sensed that the regularity, structure, and pattern of having the same seat every class created comfort. For the first semester, Lan almost never spoke, yet was never absent. Lan was Vietnamese-American in a primarily white school. It didn't appear that Lan had many friends. It was clear that, like many other 15-year-olds, Lan struggled with shyness, connecting with others, and social anxiety. Lan was one of those students who drank up the contemplative technologies of the class and the overall environment as if it was medicine. I think in a way it was. In every class session, we make sure to bring all voices into the room. This philosophy has been significantly enriched by Inward Bound Mindfulness Education, a nonprofit that offers teen mindfulness retreats. With their permission, we incorporated their lightning rounds into our curriculum. At the beginning of a class, as students are getting to know each other, the lightning round creates a way for each teen to be seen and heard. Students say their name, the pronouns they go by, and answer to a simple prompt, perhaps something like, "What are you present to in this moment?" Lan seemed particularly still and notably focused as we made our way around the lightning round at the start of our second semester of mindful studies. Sitting beside me, as always, Lan sat up boldly, took a deep breath, and said, "Hi, I'm Lan. I go by they, them." Lan came out as transgender for the first time to an entire room of teenagers, most of whom Lan didn't know. Lan went on to say more in the next 2 minutes than I had heard them say in the entire prior semester. Lan admitted that they'd been struggling with their gender identity for years and that they'd never had an outlet to explore anything beyond a conditioned view of male and female. Semester after semester, to my delight, I saw Lan's name on the roster. Lan took the class 4 times before graduating. The perceived duality of male versus female. Pearson Schools prioritizes an inclusive, responsive environment, but I must confess that when I was first introduced to including pronouns in our initial student introductions, it didn't make sense to me. I had for years been steeped in a training that focused on who we are beyond personal identity, and I knew the benefit of this focus in my own life deeply. As a monastic, I was trained to see identity as illusory, not the whole of who we are. While I experienced this statement as true and helpful on one level, it wasn't until I began the work of Peace in Schools that I experienced the fallout from how my conditioned mind equated identity is illusory to identity doesn't matter. Through working with teens and others in Peace in Schools, I've come to understand the value of honoring personal identity, of stepping into shoes that fit. I have been awed to witness the shift that can happen. When these shoes are on and fit comfortably, we often have more access to the ease and joy of our own being, leading to an ease around accessing being at large. I've witnessed that this is especially important in cases where identity is marginalized by dominant culture. You don't have to look far to see that trans people are more likely to be the recipients of hate crimes than cisgendered people, and that this violence has significantly risen in the last decade. In the world of relative experience, identity matters. At the monastery where I trained, we were not required to shave our heads. Not long into my training, however, I decided to do so, and I kept it shaved for quite some time. I knew that I derived a strong sense of self through my long blonde hair, through being feminine, through identifying as a woman. Shaving my head was a way to challenge this conditioning, to feel what arose when I let go of this external definition of who I saw myself to be and who I thought others saw. But perhaps most importantly, who I thought others valued. It was a deeply freeing experience to have no hair, to let go of some of my conditioning around gender and sexuality. I've experienced directly how many people, like Lan, feel deeply boxed in by the binary construct of gender. And because I'm steeped in the practice of recognizing duality, it's clear to me how conditioned we are to perceive reality through the lens of right versus wrong, good versus bad, black versus white. It isn't a huge leap from there to see how and why it might be valuable for someone to question what they've been conditioned to believe about themselves regarding their gender, especially when I reflect on the freedom I felt in challenging my gender identity at the monastery. And potentially even more valuable to challenge the limitation of seeing gender dualistically altogether rather than existing along a continuum. Over the next three semesters, I saw Lon engage fearlessly with other students. Lon went from being a student who rarely spoke to a student whose sense of humor surfaced with ease. Others began to know Lon as someone who paid attention to those who might feel left out, always quick to guide them home to community, to a sense of belonging. When I first met Lon, other students might have experienced them as somewhat invisible. That invisibility ended. Lon was seen, accepted, loved within the community of the class. I witnessed Lon come to terms with the sexual trauma of their childhood, join a recovery group, come to grips with and challenge the internalized racism and transphobia that they'd been conditioned into, and stand firmly in what they described as a more fitting way to identify themselves as trans. 8 years after Lon's first mindful studies class, they now rarely miss one of my meditation groups for adults. Lon has spent extended time in retreat pursuing meditation practice and serves on the board of directors for Peace in Schools. They went from being a student any caring teacher might have worried about to an adult who is actively and confidently engaged in life. Lon went from having a primary residence of fear to having a home base in a practice of presence. This is what contemplative technologies offer us, seeing the limitation of dualistic thinking, seeing how it's structured and how it operates, stepping away from the game of polarity, becoming free, seeing through us versus them and right versus wrong, opening a door into a more authentic experience of ourselves and a more authentic expression of who we truly are. The unborn mind. What does it mean to recognize the illusory nature of identity and to hold both relative and absolute truths about identity at the same time? My first show-stopping moment around gender came when exploring the teachings of Bankei, a Japanese Zen master who lived in the 1600s. I even remember where I was sitting when I read about a woman who brought him her suffering. It was a weight she could no longer carry on her own. She was living in an era and a cultural context in which it was believed that a woman could not know her true nature, could not experience enlightenment until she was reborn as a man. She had been inconsolable. This woman wanted nothing more than to be free. Instead of merely explaining to her that her belief was not true, Bankei asked her a simple question. When do you become a woman? This can be a helpful question for all of us. When do you become fill in the blank? A woman? Vietnamese American, blonde, someone with an eating disorder, a person who was abused as a child, just to give a few examples of forms we can identify with. When in our minds do we leave the undifferentiated experience of being? And I specifically state in our minds, for that's the only place this leaving occurs. When in our minds do we attach onto the notion, I am fill in the blank? When do we latch onto and fixate on a specific identity? The moment we do, the perception of duality appears within the play, the production that we are a finite self. I am broken. I need to be healed. I'm fat. I should be thin. I'm a failure. I long for success. Bankei referred to our vast, unlimited being as the unborn mind, or Buddha mind. It's the mind before the thought of identity, before any thought. This unborn mind is the same in each of us. In fact, it's not that we each have a separate unborn mind, minds that share or have similar or maybe even the same qualities. There is simply one unborn mind, one shared being, one consciousness. And within that one consciousness, many appearances arise. The appearance of a woman, the appearance of a man, the appearance of a trans person. When do you become any of them? When do you grab hold as if that identity is the totality of who you truly are? Who are you before identity? All right, dear ones, get a journal or just have a pen handy, or you could type it in the notes on your computer. I'm going to do a little exercise with you. This is, of course, optional. If you want to just listen along, that's fine. But for those of you who are eager to fully participate, it'll be nice to be able to write a few things down. I thought I would, because I'm focusing tonight on duality, the way in which our conditioned mind perceives right versus wrong, good versus bad, black versus white, this versus that. And that's not inherently necessarily the source of all suffering, but it is the source of suffering, that way that the conditioned mind perceives duality translates into I see myself as the subject and you are the object, or life is the object, or the world is the object. That is an experience of separation. I am here, life, the world, you are over there. That reinforces a notion, the illusion of separation that is the source of suffering. So I find it very juicy in practice to dive into how does duality as a perception get maintained, stay maintained? How does it form? How does it stay maintained? What keeps it in place? So as this practice in the book is called Exploring Duality. And so one way we can hone in on this is to bring question to what we are not, bring attention to what we are not. So doing so can guide us to our inherent freedom, the freedom that exists prior to the appearance of duality. So I want to start by focusing on the what we are not. Okay, so visualize a time in your life, a little bit of a guided imagery here. Visualize a time in your life where you felt stuck in a particular duality. So really try to see it. So see yourself in a moment where you can recognize that while you were identified with one side of the duality, you believed X. And then when you were identified with the other side of the duality, you believed Y. Just say, for example, you're struggling with, should I stay or should I go? And you do get extra points if you sing that line. Okay. So perhaps this duality has a really light emotional charge. Should I stay home or should I go to work today? Or perhaps this duality has tremendous impact. Should I stay in this marriage? It's totally fine if your scenario involves another person, but if it does, just focus on your own inner process for now. So on your piece of paper or in your notes on your computer, or if you're just listening along, visualize it. Column A is going to be, in my example, I should stay. Okay. Column B is going to be, I should go. So pick your own duality, someplace that you recognize. If you're identified with one side of the duality, you believe these things. If you identify with the other side of the duality, you believe these things. And then you're going to visualize yourself identified with the part of you who wants to stay. So now I'm on column A. What do you say to yourself about why you should stay? You're going to write down all your self-talk when you're identified with this side of the page. Things like, if I'm using this example of I should stay, if I leave, I'll be a coward. Or there are really no good reasons to leave. Or I'm afraid to leave. Or it's better here. So I'm going to give you a minute to just write down all the things you say to yourself when you're on that side of the duality. Okay, next. And you can work on this more later if you're finding this to be juicy. I encourage you to go back and fill more of the self-talk in, because that's how we recognize we're identified, is by being aware of the self-talk. So next, see yourself on the other side of the duality. So you're going to write down the negative self-talk you're present to when you're identified with column B. So in this case, I should go. So this would be things like, if I stay, I'll be a coward, or there are really no good reasons to stay, or I'm afraid to stay, or it's better there. So you're simply brain dumping all the things you believe to be true when you're identified in each way. What I love about writing these things down is the writing itself is a process of disidentification, because you're letting these beliefs be at arm's length, and you can recognize from there that they are not you. So I'll give you a few moments for that side. And remember, you can do this with anything. It need not just be stay or go. You might flesh out this process with, was I right or was I wrong? Is X worthy to pursue, or is X futile to pursue? Should I have fill in the blank, or should I not have fill in the blank? Dualities are endless. Why? Because when we look through the lens of duality, everything seen appears to be dualistic. What's important about this exercise is to see what you say to yourself when you're on one side of the duality, then explore what you say to yourself when you're on the other side of the duality. The perception of duality is maintained through self-talk. A dualistic view cannot be kept in place without it. Recognizing this self-talk helps us recognize when this perception has taken hold. Often we're so identified with one side of the duality, specifically with the content on that side of the duality, that we miss the process we go through when bouncing from one side of the duality to the other. To take this beyond the recognition of self-talk or merely belief, read column A to yourself now and just notice what happens in your body and within your energetic system. In other words, pay attention to how these thoughts affect not only your mind, but also your body and your energy. Then see yourself on the other side of the duality. So read this column to yourself now, the column B, and just notice how these thoughts and these beliefs and assumptions affect you on the level of sensation. What happens energetically? And you explore this without getting sucked into the content, but rather simply experiencing the result of being identified with this side of the duality. Now, like a drone, zoom out and get an even broader view. You've brought attention to what it feels like to identify with each side of the duality. Now bring attention to what it feels like to bounce from one side to the other, rather than strictly focusing on the result of identifying with each side of the duality. So what's the result of pinging between the sides, of seeking and resisting in this way? Of identifying with a separate self that flings back and forth. But that's what it's like, isn't it? We thrash back and forth. What would shift if we remained on one side of the duality all the time with no resistance? I'm not suggesting that freedom lies in simply choosing one side of the duality, but it can be fruitful to just inquire into this. Would we suffer if there was no resistance? Would we suffer if there was no comparing? Freedom lies in our capacity to disidentify from the created duality, to return to a direct experience of unity. From this direct experience of unity, we are able to accept and embrace what is. In complete acceptance, is there any residue of dissatisfaction? With nothing to compare our experience to, nothing to hold up against it, how would we suffer? Where would the issue be? We suffer when we create an alternate reality that does not exist. We suffer when we compare what is to what could be, or according to the conditioned mind, what should be. So can you see the part of you now who gets flung around in the bouncing back and forth? What if, with a sense of play, we're making all this up, you saw this tossed about part of you as a young person that you love? Would it be easy to recognize the battle they get caught in? See the suffering that results. What would you want to say to this person? Would it feel easy to access the way the whole drama is created? Not required, not helpful. Would you be able to see this person through the eyes of compassion? So So I want to give you a moment now just to look over your notes and reflect on all of the lines of inquiry that I opened. Maybe take some notes that are reflections of what's arising now as you reflect on this.